we introduce ourselves. And then you start and tell them what you do that way. And then the members will also introduce themselves. I'll be the last speaker.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Anele Siwa. I'm an ANC researcher deployed in COCTA. Thank you so much.
As for Nandine Bonus, I'm the legal counsel of Freedom of Religion South Africa, for example.
My name is Michael Swain. I am the executive director of Freedom of Religion South Africa, for SA.
Good morning. I am Daniela Illebeck, and I'm an attorney and employed as the legal advisor also with 4SA.
Good morning. My name is Brian Adams, not a singer. I'm from the PRO, Deputy Minister of Petabela. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Valerie Peterson. I'm from the Khoisan Royal House in Western Cape. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Tamrin Costa. I'm from the Royal House of Khoisan.
Good day. I'm Sureshni Governor, the media officer for the committee. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Gisela Osterman, a member of the committee.
Good day. I'm Michael Grunewald, also a member of the committee.
Good day. My name is Kanya Pereza, member of the committee.
Thank you. I'm Kalusi here, member of the committee.
Good morning, I'm Ngozi Lotlhole, member of this committee.
Good morning, I'm Sujit Sinsila Kabanchaba, a member of this committee. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Makiko, a member of this committee.
Good morning, boss. I'm Tonika Mbunza, a member of the board of the committee.
And my name is Faith Mutan, I am the chairperson of the committee. Okay, over to you, Michael. I suspect you are the leader of the delegation.
Well, good morning, Chairperson, thank you so much, committee members, honourable members, for this opportunity. And we will certainly hope that it will be a brief, not too boring, but nevertheless, I believe we're going to be speaking about some very important things which I know you have already been made aware of. And so we are hoping that this will be a helpful and informative meeting for you. And it's very much a privilege to be part of a democratic process where we can come and meet honourable members and committee members and actually make views and hopefully respond to questions. Let me give you a little brief background about Freedom of Religion South Africa. We're known as 4SA. We were established in 2014, and we are very importantly responsible and have a mandate to protect and promote religious freedom rights in South Africa for all faiths and all religions. We are, to that extent, also doctrinally neutral. We don't take a particular viewpoint on any faith or faith position, but we are obviously interested in what the law says, and we're very much also defenders of the rule of law. We do not believe in any way, shape, or form that freedom of religion gives you a license to break laws or to flout laws. I think perhaps just to say what we also do, we're very much involved in engaging with parliamentary processes such as this one. Chapter 9 of the Constitution, we're involved in court cases, sometimes as a principal, sometimes as an amicus. And really we get involved in areas which we believe affect the constitutional rights that we've been granted to enjoy religious freedom in this nation. We represent, in terms of numbers of people who've basically given us a mandate to represent them, approximately 5 million people from various
aspects of the faith community. And obviously my colleagues, you have been introduced to them, so I will not introduce them again. Thank you for that opportunity. I just want to start off by asking, has everybody received one of these presentations? Okay, wonderful. So let me give you a brief purpose and the format of this presentation. We're obviously here today to talk principally about the whole issue of regulation of religion, the CRL Rights Commission report on the commercialization of religion and the abuse of people's belief systems. And we believe it's very important to just quickly jog through the process of what's happened to date, what has brought us to this point. We're obviously not here in a vacuum. We're here very much as a part of the process that is unfolding. And also, importantly, to explain why 4SA has, from the very inception of this matter, believed and contended that the recommendations in the report are essentially for peer review mechanisms, are essentially unconstitutional, unnecessary, and unworkable, and my colleagues will be dealing with the legal aspects there. As well as also, because again, and I think it's probably good to start off by saying, we absolutely appreciate, accept, and have been very supportive and concerned about some of the abuses that have been seen coming out of the faith community. We are certainly in no way, shape, or form defending that whatsoever. What we do believe is that they are important issues that need to be addressed, but we do believe that there are existing alternative solutions which will address all the issues raised by the CRL Rights Report. And to that end, we will be taking you through those at the end. And also, of course, to answer any questions that any member may have for clarification or explanation or further information. So without more ado, the report on the commercialization and of religion and the abuse of people's belief systems began the process, the CRL began the process in August 2015, and they ran effectively about a 7-month process. They launched an investigation. Unfortunately, I think as well, this matter has become quite controversial, sometimes quite adversarial, which is, I think, an unfortunate situation, but nevertheless, that's what we live with. It was begun by the issuing of subpoenas to 85 religious leaders and organizations, and also the CRL commissioned a study from UNISA, which in fact was a very, very restricted study. It's only surveyed 905 congregants and churches and only in the Gauteng area, so it really was not therefore representative. I think it's important to say that in this process, obviously important issues came to light and the report was duly compiled, and that was released, the preliminary report was released in 2016. And what was of course concerning were immediately the recommendations, not so much the issues that it highlighted, but the recommendations and the solutions which it proposed. And essentially the essence of the concern and ultimately the contention came surrounding peer review mechanisms and the fact that the CRL in its report stated that it would be the final arbiter of religion and also given the final decision powers regarding any dispute in the religious community. Now, it is true that the CRL has subsequently stated that their role can be replaced by another state institution. But nevertheless, if any institution of state is ultimately the final arbiter of religion and the final decision-making authority of any religious dispute, that does effectively mean that the state is regulating religion. And that is something which is obviously of great concern. There is an organogram of what the CRL Rights Commission proposed, which is also in the notes. I think importantly, you can see that at the top you have the CRL Rights Commission, or whoever might replace that. That is slide number 8. And what you will see is that every religion will have a peer review committee. There may be more than one peer review committee per religion, but essentially the goal is to have one per religion. And that means that leaders of that religion, whatever they may be, Christian, Rastafarian, Baha'i, Confucian, they would have leaders appointed effectively to, in a very real sense, oversee that area of the faith community. And they in turn would be responsible for the approval of what are called umbrella organizations. These are organizations which could be networks of churches, they could be fraternals, they could be denominations, but they would obviously have to be approved in order to function in that, in the role that is envisaged. And then every single religious practitioner, which was never properly or in any way defined and is therefore quite nebulous as to who would qualify, would have to, with their associated worship center, register with one of these umbrella organizations. We're going to talk about the legal implications of that at a later point, so I won't elaborate, other than to say that obviously that is very much a regulatory framework rather than a facilitating framework in the sense that we believe it should be in terms of allowing for freedom to continue in the religious sector. So to give you a brief summary of the process, obviously when this report came out, it was a cause of deep concern. And there were many, many submissions that were made. People obviously applied their minds carefully to the Sierra Rights Commission's report and made submissions to them with a view to obviously having those submissions taken into account. It was only a first draft. To give you a couple of instances, and maybe this will give you a sense of the concern in the faith community. And I think it's probably also worthwhile saying that the abuses that were identified in the report, and which unfortunately do continue from time to time within our society, they are committed by literally a tiny fractional minority of people in the faith community. It is by no means representative of what has happened, what's been reported in the papers, of what generally happens in the faith community. The faith community plays a critical and vital part in South African society. We are very much a society with people of faith. And it also does, of course, a tremendous amount of good and in supporting structures, which obviously, again, is very much part of the benefits which was provided and the cement of the society in which we live in. But to give you just a quick snapshot out of presentations, the Anglican Church stated in its petition, when it examined the implications of the recommendations, that it will petition the president if this thing was enacted or came to fruition. It will go to the Constitutional Court or to the highest court of the land if necessary. And it says in the report that last resort must be defiance of an unjust law. And coming from the Anglican Church, which is normally extremely conservative in its views, that is quite a comment. The Catholic Church stated that the CRL's proposals, and here I'm quoting, constitute a massive limitation of the right to freedom of religion, and if they become law, will be found to be unconstitutional. Unfortunately, the CRL didn't take into account the submissions that were made. They made minimal amendments to their report, and that report was then reissued in June, and very shortly thereafter, COGTA, this committee, your predecessors, held the first day of hearings. Again, it was concerning to us, the meeting. We were obviously very involved in this from the beginning. We were one of the first 85. We were literally, as the Honourable Chair knows, we certainly knock on the door if we want to find the opportunity to meet. We were knocking on the door on a daily basis. We eventually were given a half a day's notice of the meeting, which was a much bigger meeting than this. And when we attended that meeting, it was full of people. All the Sierra Rights Commission were there. There were religious leaders were there too. And unanimously, the CRL's proposal was supported, except for one small problem. Nobody could actually oppose the report, of which there were literally, as it turned out, millions and millions of people represented by their leadership were represented in that first meeting. Fortunately, 4SA was there. We gave an impromptu. We were invited by the chair to make some impromptu statements, which we did. And essentially, we said that this meeting, unfortunately, was not representative of the faith community. And we asked for further hearings to be conducted. And COGTA graciously agreed to that. Those hearings were held in October 2017, 2 days of hearings. and senior leaders from many of the major denominations, religious organizations, other faith groups, African traditional religion was obviously also represented, made submissions to the parliament and to COGTA. Probably those people numerically represented conservatively 15 million people from the faith community and possibly as many as 20 million people. And everybody unanimously recognized that unacceptable abuses were being committed by a fringe minority under the guise of freedom of religion. And as we will say, you cannot hide an illegal act behind freedom of religion. But we noted, and it was generally noted, that the vast majority of the abuses were actually simply criminal acts that should be and could be dealt with by the state. The leaders and delegates universally and unanimously rejected the CRL's recommendation to effectively regulate the religious sector. Again, the headings were unnecessary, unworkable, and unconstitutional, and we will come to that. And there was general support for an opportunity, particularly for the faith community, to engage with these issues and to have the opportunity to discuss solutions by the religious community and for the religious community. In February 2018, this committee, your predecessor, issued their report, and they rejected the CRL's recommendations. But they did propose that the CRL should organize a national religious leaders consultation to give the religious community a platform to discuss challenges in the religious sector. They also recommended that a code of conduct be developed, which essentially would provide a benchmark and a standard to which all bona fide religious organizations would voluntarily subscribe. And also that there should be some form of, and I put it in my words, a gap analysis of relevant laws. Where those laws exist, for example, the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa, ICASA, was mentioned because of misleading media claims, for example. And also legislation could be perhaps considered, which governs areas like non-profit organizations, the Income Tax Act, and really to ensure that some of the compliance issues were addressed correctly. COGTA was very clear in what it had required, but the CRL were very unhappy with the result. The then chairperson basically said that they did not...
The one she said you were not elated with the result of the outcome of the portfolio committee.
No, she wasn't that.
Was not happy.
No, she was not happy. She actually claimed that, first of all, they didn't have money to convene the conference, and they also said that they wanted to go to the Constitutional Court to confirm that they already had the power to regulate the religious community. So far as we know, that case never was filed. And they also said that they would now continue to lobby via the press, media attention, and obviously the politicians, with a view to getting the recommendations which COGTA had rejected, new life and new traction. So, in response to this, first of all, in May, the Evangelical Association of South Africa, TISA, convened a meeting with 70 of the senior religious leaders of the country. Almost all the denominations were represented there. It actually took place on the back of an SACC event. And there it was mandated to give the drafters of the South African Religious Freedom Charter. That is a charter which was developed by the South African Council for the Protection and Promotion of Religious Rights and Freedoms, and that was developed really some years ago now, and it essentially elaborates on the religious freedom rights. It's an exposition of those rights and a very good summary. And that charter was basically endorsed and supported by 22 million people from all different sectors of the faith community. The mandate at the meeting that TISA organized was to basically ask those same people, if these are the rights that we have, well, obviously you cannot and should not have a right without a responsibility. And so therefore, they were asked to draft effectively a document of the responsibilities that correspond to the rights that were expounded in the Religious Freedom Charter. And this has subsequently been drafted. It's been widely circulated. It is not a closed document. It is currently in its third draft, and many involved in the religious sector are familiar with it. to fast forward a little bit, in September 2018, the CRL Commission went to Pastor Ray McCauley, who you may be familiar with. He is the head of the IFCC, as well as the National Religious Leaders Council, and they asked him to convene a Religious Leaders Summit. However, they were very clear that they would be monitoring this process closely to ensure that their agenda was adopted. Problematic in that, of course, was that the CRL, nobody who basically had sent submissions opposing the CRL's recommendations were included in the task team that organized that meeting, nor were they included in the drafting of the agenda for that meeting. So the meeting then took place on the 13th of February, 2019. I think it's important to say that unfortunately, again, the agenda for that meeting was only distributed the evening before, and obviously those who came to the meeting were already unhappy at having been excluded from the agenda, and when they saw the agenda, it was evident that effectively what it was a reintroduction of everything which the CRL had originally proposed. A legal constitutional framework to put forward proposals for legislation, to develop an accountability system, the peer review committee system, and the meeting was supposed to draft a declaration which would actually effectively show that the faith community supported and endorsed what the CRL were proposing. There was also a code of conduct which the CRL had drafted, not obviously the one that had been mandated by the faith community earlier that year. The meeting was, I think somebody described it as robust. It really culminated in resolutions that the CRL really should not be engaging directly and dictating to the church and the faith community how it should regulate its affairs, but it did resolve that there should be a broad consultative process at a local, provincial and national level to develop the solutions which COGTA had already asked the religious community to do. And the CRL was then informed in writing of those resolutions that were taken at that meeting. Then, a few days later, the CRL's National Consultative Conference took place. And although there was an opportunity for feedback from that Religious Leaders Summit, which incidentally was co-organized by the CRL and issued invitations on their letterhead with Pastor McCauley, they did not recognize any of those resolutions that had been taken. And instead, a resolution was passed at the NCC where the composition of members at that meeting literally are a fraction of them come from the faith community. The vast majority come from just community leaders. But they passed a resolution saying that the CRL must continue ensuring there is a peer review mechanism and advancing and promoting a process to control religious practitioners and also pushing for the proposals that they have placed before the nation and parliament, which of course, as I said, had already been rejected by COGTA at previous hearings and certainly were rejected by the Religious Leaders Summit which had just taken place. To get a little fast forward up to date, obviously there has been a lot of consultation taking place in the faith community across the nation that are considering obviously the issues raised in the report and are looking to present alternative solutions to its recommendations, which obviously would not require further legislative change or any change perhaps to the constitution, which might have been necessitated were the CRL's recommendations to be adopted, but obviously to bring a greater level of self-regulatory accountability, calling for more effective enforcement of existing law with education training opportunities. In 2019, the CRL Rights Commission leadership changed. New commissioners were appointed. Professor David Masoma, as I'm sure you're well aware, is now the chairperson. And in 2019, they came to this committee and they made a presentation of their viewpoint and their report. And COGTA had agreed to look into the matter. So we had the privilege.
When you say COGTA, the department or
the office? I think that was you, ma'am. I think. Sorry. Thank you. In January 2020, we had the privilege and the opportunity of meeting, Honourable Chair, yourself and some members, at the conference that took place in Durban. There was a Law and Religious Communities in Africa conference. And it was a very significant conference, we felt, because it really did look at international expertise, legal expertise, academic expertise, international experience, and the keynote presenters really gave a very good framework of how international law looks at regulation of religion. Obviously, they started off by saying that freedom of religion and belief is a fundamental and inalienable human right. It's not a right that the state grants. It's actually a right which you enjoy. It's inherent to you simply as part of your worth as a human being. And importantly, when they're talking about registration, not regulation, but registration, they were of the unanimous view that registration was there really to facilitate the participation of religious communities within the legal framework, within the society, within the rule of law of a nation. It was not there in any way to try and exclude anybody, but rather to facilitate participation. And they further were very clear that any form of regulation that might restrict that in terms of international human rights and law, it is likely, as was the case in Nigeria, where the Nigerian government tried this, to place any state which does so on what they called a watch list or as a country of particular concern. So we shortly thereafter that meeting went to Johannesburg. We had a very cordial meeting with the CRL, Professor Masomo and his deputy chair and the CEO were there, and we affirmed our support for the work and role of the CRL. We have a very similar mandate. Yeah, we had a very good meeting. Yes, we even hugged. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, there we did. And we had a very cordial, very good meeting. I really felt that we, you know, I think we both felt that we, Nadine and I were there, that we found one another. We were able to explain perhaps some of the positions in more detail and obviously to discuss our concerns and of course to present the alternative solutions, which we did. And as I said, it was a very good and a very positive meeting. So thank you so much, Chair, for helping to just nudge that one across the finish line. It was very helpful. Because again, we believe in participative solution finding, and that's what we're here for. So without more ado, that gives you, I think, a little sense of how we got where we are today. We then got a very wonderful and gracious invitation to come and present here today, and we trust this will be helpful. I'm now going to hand over to Daniela Ellebeck, our attorney. And she has done extensive research in existing laws, and she will take you through how the existing laws actually do cover already the concerns and the issues that are raised in the CRL reports, which, as I said, we certainly do not minimize. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, for that introduction. As Michael said, I will be focusing on the existing laws and why the CRL's recommendations are necessary. Advocate Barnwell, whose presentation will focus on why it is unconstitutional and unworkable, will follow mine. Now, first of all, I want to start by saying that the law applies equally to all. Everyone here would be familiar with Section 9 that says everyone is equal under the law. Now, what that means is whether you are a politician, a postman, or a pastor, we are all equal before the law. And everyone lives under the rule of law, and our criminal justice system applies equally to everyone. And a crime, even if it is committed under the cloak of freedom of religion, is still a crime. Now, churches and pastors must operate under the rule of law, and if they contravene a law, they are committing a crime. Now, one of the common misstatements that have been made is that it's not a crime if the victim is a willing participant. I want to put it clearly and unequivocally that this statement is just plain wrong. So the state has an interest in prosecuting all crimes. For example, Allah says that even if I was specifically to ask Shireen, for example, to kill me, and she decides to oblige me and put my life to an end, she, under our law, would still be guilty of the crime of murder. Just because I was a voluntary participant and I asked her to do it, she doesn't escape any responsibility under our criminal justice system for it. So the state has a duty to protect the public, and because of that, it has an interest in bringing all criminals to justice for all crimes, even if your consent was to your own detriment. Now, this afternoon, I will focus on those notorious acts that have made media headlines and show how they are clearly criminal acts that are squarely covered by the South African criminal law system. Now, given the time constraints of this afternoon, and I'm aware that members have to be in the House at 2, so we will try and get through what we have to say as speedily as possible, I will only focus on the most prominent ones. But we have taken the liberty, after the slide presentation, which members have in front of them, at the back of that is a bundle of articles we have written about all of the cases that have come up, that we have come across on the internet when doing research and how the laws cover them. So they are more fully expounded on in your bundle. Now, firstly, looking at rape and sexual offences. Recently, some pastors have made headlines for allegedly committing sexual crimes such as rape or human trafficking. The most well-known amongst these is probably Timothy Omotoso. I'm assuming most committee members have heard of his case going on currently. Now, irrespective of who commits a rape, it remains a crime. Now, if someone consents to sex because they believe that if they don't, something bad will happen to them, that is not consent, and it is still rape, which is punishable with a minimum sentence of up to 10 years. Furthermore, unwanted sexual acts that fall short of penetration, so penetration would be rape, but unwanted sexual acts that fall short of penetration are the crimes of sexual assault. And Timothy Omotoso is also being prosecuted for this crime as he allegedly sexually assaulted Cheryl Zondi, another name that most of the committee members no doubt are aware of. Turning to keeping children from school, so everyone here will remember the Seven Angels cult in the Eastern Cape, where children were reportedly being withheld from school. Now, this is a crime. If you withhold or keep a child from going to school, that is a crime in terms of the South African Schools Act that can end you up in jail for 6 months. I also want to just pause here and mention that the Seven Angels cult had sex trafficking, they possessed illegal firearms, they committed armed robbery and murder. So it's important to state that the actions of these cult members do not even vaguely resemble a church. And what was evidently going on here is nothing less than a criminal gang. Now, who here has heard of the Prophet of Doom? I'm assuming he's quite infamous, and I'm assuming most people would know him. Now, the Prophet of Doom was infamous for spraying his congregants of doom, which is in fact a pesticide that is quite common in every South African household. He was subsequently and correctly charged with and found guilty of 4 counts of assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm, or commonly known as assault GBH. In addition, he was also found guilty of contravening the Fertilizers, Farm Fees, Agricultural Remedies, and Stocked Remedies Act. Now, what this illustrates is that statement that we mentioned in the beginning, that it is not a crime if the victim is a willing participant, is clearly nonsense. Because although his congregants consented to letting him spray them with doom, this did not immunize them from being found guilty of assault GBH and underneath the aforementioned act. It also clearly shows that when properly applied and enforced, our laws and our justice systems are more than able to deal with these matters. Okay, so other pastors have made headlines for having their followers drink water laced with rat poison, such as Ratex or ancient cleaning fluid. Now you may ask, Daniela, does the law have anything to say about this? Well, actually it does, because if I were to give you a noxious substance, a poisonous substance to eat or drink, I would be committing the crime of administering poison. So that is what those pastors made themselves guilty of. Then there was also the controversial snake pastor, Penny Munguni, who is infamous for feeding, or was infamous for feeding, live snakes to his congregation. I don't know if any of the committee members saw that on the news. Well, in terms of the Animal Protection Act, he should be sent to jail for a year because of animal cruelty, which has a minimum sentence of 1 year. And then, what about when one's congregants go on a wild rampage through the city? I don't know if committee members are aware of that having happened, but 2019 saw 23 congregants of the International Pentecostal Holiness Church in Limpopo arrested after they went on a violent rampage where they assaulted each other and damaged vehicles. Now, in our criminal law, when a number of people commit serious violent acts that disturb the public peace and security, they are committing the crime of public violence. And that is what these 23 congregants were charged and found guilty of. Now, what I want to say is that the crime of public violence carries a minimum sentence of 5 years. So, what about when a pastor makes false or fantastical claims? Does the law have anything to say about that, and can it help us at all? Well, assuming that money is exchanged and therefore a contractual relationship is established, it's important to know that when a pastor communicates in a way that brings a good or service to someone's attention and that then encourages them to make use of that good or service, the pastor is in fact advertising. And this situation would apply, for example, where a pastor is selling conference tickets, as happened to a conference in Joburg, where tickets range from 5,000 to 10,000 rand, and he guarantees that after praying for you and anointing your ring finger with oil, you would be married within 3 months. Now that is advertising. And this might come as a surprise to some, but such claims fall squarely under the Code of Good Advertising Practice, and importantly, the Consumer Protection Act and the Common Law. Now, the Consumer Protection Act defines advertising as any communication, whether it's said by, you know, a salesperson or by a pastor, by which a person seeks to bring goods or services to people's attention and promote use thereof. Now, in South Africa, pastors have made front page news for making all kinds of fantastical claims and promises if you pay the money. Some churches even sell various good luck or faith products that have been prayed over and blessed by the pastor, such as holy water, oil, Vaseline. And here, for example, I can specifically refer you to the CRL's report where they list these examples on page 31. However, many of these are in fact advertising that are potentially in breach of the Consumer Protection Act. The Act says that no one must advertise any good or service in any way that is deceptive, misleading, fraudulent regarding the advantages of using the good or service or its nature and properties. So, for example, this means that if a pastor sells his congregants Vaseline and tells them it will heal them of their HIV infection because he has blessed it, the pastor is breaking the Consumer Protection Act because he is misleading his congregants to believe that using this particular Vaseline has certain advantages and possesses different properties to those typically claimed by Vaseline. Now, under the Consumer Protection Act, he can then be liable under civil law for various things such as damages, but importantly, he can also be referred to the National Prosecuting Authority for criminal investigation. Lastly, even if a pastor does not charge someone money, so neither the Code of Good Advertising Practice nor the Consumer Protection Act apply, but he intentionally causes you to believe something that he knows to be false, he can, and arguably should, be prosecuted for the common law crime of fraud, as has happened in the case of the fake resurrection pastor, Alf Lacau. Now, pastors have also been in the headlines for commercial crimes. Example of this would be the arrest of Prophet Bushiri and his wife by the Hawks on charges of money laundering. Now, money laundering is the crime of trying to make dirty money, so money that you obtain from unlawful proceeds, clean or appear clean as if it was obtained legally. An example would be where the mafia recorded the money they made from selling drugs, so dirty money, in the books of a laundromat they owned as if it were proceeds from the laundromat, so making it appear as if it was clean money. Similarly, just being in the possession of unlawful or proceeds of unlawful activities is a crime, as is assisting someone to benefit from the proceeds of crime. What I want to point out is that all of these crimes that I have mentioned are covered by the Prevention of Organized Crimes Act and carry a 30-year jail sentence. Equally, if someone fails to report commercial crimes such as theft, fraud, and forgery to the police, such failure would also be a crime. Now, another big issue that has made headlines is failure to pay taxes. And I want to point out that pastors, just like everybody else, if they earn an income, must pay income tax, or pay YE. Should a pastor misrepresent as far as his or her annual income, they become liable to a penalty in terms of the Tax Administration Act, which deals with the penalties imposed for various forms of tax offences and understatements, such as, for example, making a misrepresentation on your tax return. Also, a church is not automatically tax exempt. To be tax exempt, they have to be registered as a PBO, a public benefit organization with SARS. Otherwise, they are taxed like normal companies. Now, in conclusion, what I want to say is that it is clear that our South African legal system is well developed and that suitable remedies exist that offer a wide range of solutions to the problems identified in the CRL's report. The law is the law, and anyone, a congregant, another church or religious organization, a member of the public, or even the CRL itself, who becomes aware of such unlawful conduct, has the right to lay a complaint against such a pastor or church with the relevant authority. Thank you, and I'll hand over to my learned colleague, Atke Bonhorst.
Good afternoon, and a sincere thanks again to the Chair and the members of this committee for allowing us to present before you today. So as you heard, my name is Advocate Nadine Barnhorst. I am the full-time legal counsel of Forest Bay. You've been so patient with us already. Thank you so much. But what I want to do in the last remaining time at our disposal is to highlight some of our concerns relating to the CRL's recommendations, emphasizing once again that we agree with the CRL that there are isolated incidents of abuse that are happening in the religious sector, and these need to be addressed. What we do not agree with, however, is what is the solution to these problems that we are seeing in the religious sector, and we do not agree with the proposed solutions offered by the CRL. And the reason for that being three things, really, as has already been pointed out. Firstly, we believe that the proposed solutions by the CRL are unnecessary in light of the vast array of laws and legal remedies that already apply in South African law, as my colleague Danella just explained. But secondly also, we believe that what the CRL is proposing, and I'll take you through it, is unconstitutional and thirdly also unworkable. So I'll focus on the unconstitutional and the unworkable. And I want to refer you in the document, I'll be dealing with the slides from pages 10 onwards to the end, starting with slide 28, regulation is unconstitutional and unworkable. So why do we say that what the CRL is proposing is unconstitutional? That starts on slide 29. Members of the committee, it is so important to understand that up until now, the historic relationship and the constitutional arrangements between the state and religion has always been one of cooperation. So freedom of religion is fundamentally guaranteed, it's constitutionally guaranteed in section 15 of the Constitution. And what that right means, and the Constitutional Court has said on various occasions, it means it grants individuals, therefore also religious practitioners, but also religious institutions and communities, maximum freedom, not only to believe in their hearts whatever they want to believe, but the right also to say what they believe, but also the right to practice their faith within the law of the land. And on the other hand, it places a duty on the state to create a positive environment for religion and religious freedom to thrive. Now, the problem that we're sitting with is, should the CRL's recommendations be adopted, it would completely change this historic and constitutional arrangement of cooperation between the state and religion. Because effectively what it would do is it would make the CRL, who may I remind you in terms of Chapter 9 of the Constitution, is an institution of state, the head of religion, all religion in South Africa. Now, if that makes you sit up, I refer you to slide 50 in the bundle before you. That's the organogram. And that organogram is a direct copy from the CRL's own final report, and that's been placed before this committee, page 42 of it. And one only needs to look at the organogram to really see what the CRL is proposing. And if you look carefully there, unfortunately it is a bit small, but right at the top of that elaborate structure it says CRL Rights Commission. So effectively what they are proposing is that they would oversee, that they would control, that they would have the final say over all religious bodies, organizations across the faith spectrum in South Africa. And that is also emphasized by or highlighted by other comments that are made by the CRL in the report, such as that the CRL is proposed to be the final arbiter in all matters of religion in South Africa. That is on page 48 of the final report, with, quote unquote, the final decision powers, page 47 of the CRL's final report. Now the fact is, honourable members, that it was never intended, either in terms of the Constitution or in terms of the CRL's own Act of 2002, for the CRL to take up this role of control, this role of licensing that it now claims for itself. In fact, if one looks to the Constitution, which creates the CRL, Chapter 9 thereof, and indeed to the CRL Act, one sees very clearly, and I quote again, that the CRL's mandate, what they have been tasked to do, is to promote and protect the rights of religious communities, not to license, control, and regulate. Now, the very same message also recently came through at this conference to which my colleague Michael referred that we attended in Durban. It was an international conference that looked at this whole issue of regulation of religion in Africa, so broader than South Africa, and was attended also by the Honourable Chair and other members of this committee. And at that conference, international academics and lawyers were unanimous. Number one, that freedom of religion is a fundamental human right. And secondly, that it should be interfered with, therefore regulated, only in the most narrow of circumstances. And thirdly, where registration of religious organizations is required, that should never be to limit, to control religious organizations, to limit their activities. Quite the opposite. It should be to give them legal status to enable them to exercise their constitutional rights, to enable them to thrive, to enable them to actually live out their freedom of religion. So unfortunately, the CRL's recommendations, as they're contained in their report, will have a limiting rather than an enabling effect. It will make it more difficult, as I will explain now, and more costly for religious practitioners and organizations to exercise their fundamental human rights. And for this reason, we submit it would probably fall foul both of the Constitution and indeed international law. Let me give you two examples. Again, when one has regard to this organogram with the CRL Rights Commission right at the top, one sees, just to explain a little bit for those of the members perhaps who haven't seen it before, right under the CRL Commission, there are peer review committees. Now, the intention is that there should be one peer review committee per religion, so one for Christianity, one for the Muslim faith, one for the Hindu faith, and so forth. Then under them, there are various umbrella organizations, so various accredited or recognized umbrella organizations under each peer review committee, and then the worship centers and religious practitioners under the umbrella bodies. Now, what CRL is saying in their report is that every religious practitioner from whatever faith in South Africa will be forced to belong to an accredited umbrella body. Now, in the words of the CRL, the religious practitioners will be free to choose which umbrella body they want to belong to, but they cannot not belong. They are forced to belong. Now, the problem, of course, with this argument is that it completely flies in the face of the fundamental right to freedom of association, Section 18 of the Constitution. Why? Because freedom of association implies the right not to associate. I can associate with whomever I want to associate, or I don't have to at all. So any form of forced association, as suggested by the CRL, amounts to an unconstitutional violation of the right to freedom of association. And it therefore does not enable association, but it actually limits it. What is more, contrary to the CRL's suggestion that their recommendations will not touch doctrine, they're only concerned with practice, it is inevitable that the Commission, or even if the Commission had to be replaced by some kind of peer review mechanism, which I'll turn to in a moment, but they will have to take decisions regarding the acceptability of doctrinal beliefs and expression. Why do I say that? Because there's a very fine line between doctrine and practice. Practice is generally the outward expression of doctrine, of something that someone believes in their heart. And for this reason, it may be very difficult, if not impossible, to police the external practice without also touching on what people internally believe, their doctrine. And this would clearly then be a violation of the right to religious freedom, to almost look at people's beliefs, look at their doctrines, and on the basis of that decide, are we going to license them to practice as religious practitioners or not? It would be a clear violation of the right to religious freedom, which our constitutional court has time and time again entails not only the right to believe in our hearts whatever we want to believe, even if it is, as the court said in the Prince case, bizarre, illogical, irrational, as many of these things are, but it's the right also to preach those things. And it is also the right to live out those things, even if they are bizarre, illogical, or irrational. So what are peer review mechanisms? It's very clear when one has a look at this organogram that when one has the CRL as an institution of state right at the top of this structure to control religion in South Africa, we are effectively talking state regulation of religion. We can name it anything else. We can explain it away the way we want to. But if the CRL is an institution of state, sits right at the top of all these religious bodies in South Africa, that is state regulation of religion. Now, what then about peer review? Because even the CRL has said, all right, we're prepared to do away with ourselves here at the top of this body, but then the religious bodies themselves should step in, and there should be some kind of peer review. In other words, other religious bodies overseeing what is happening in the religious sector. Now, I would submit to you that even if the proposed licensing or regulation of religion had to be done not through the CRL, but rather through these accredited umbrella bodies and the peer review committees, one per religion, the same concerns regarding unconstitutionality remain. Why do I say that? Because the moment there is a law that is put in place that recognizes only some umbrella bodies and others not, and give the backing and the power of the state to those umbrella bodies to do certain things, to give a teeth, then that is state regulation of religion. The CRL report further indicates that they will offer financial and administrative support to peer review committees, which would ultimately again have the backing of the state in order to fulfill the role envisaged by the CRL. So even peer review committees are not the solution, are not constitutional, will probably not pass constitutional muster. I then move on to slide 33 at the bottom of page 11. So we've said that regulation is unconstitutional. My colleague has dealt with why it's unnecessary in light of all the laws and legal remedies that we already have in South Africa. The third point that we want to make, and it's a shorter point, is that regulation is also unworkable. And why do we say that? Because it's very difficult to see how this elaborate structure, the organogram that the CRL is proposing, will work in practice. Let's use Christianity as an example. There are literally tens of thousands of denominations, non-denominational and independent churches or church groupings just in South Africa. And the reason why there are so many is because even though everybody reads the same book, the Bible, all of them have such different interpretations on the different scriptures, what it means, how it should be applied, how it should be lived out. And it is with respect very difficult to imagine how one peer review committee could come into existence for all these tens of thousands of groups and would be able to represent them all adequately or properly. Who would sit on this peer review committee? Who would these people be who represent these tens of thousands? And even if a specific faith has a peer review committee which is segmented further, for example, one for Shiites and one for Sunni Muslims, it would inevitably exclude some whose doctrinal interpretation or practice differed from the mainstream. So we need to be very careful, and then again, it's very difficult to imagine how could one member from each peer review committee now represent all these people on what is called the peer review council, which hangs there in the air on the right and which is supposed to be a body who decides whether a new faith is allowed into South Africa at all or not. But mostly the concern has been raised that since we have so many laws in South Africa in place already, and those appear not to be sufficient to deal with abuses, or rather, they're not being implemented at the moment, how will, if we create an additional layer of laws, as the CRL is proposing, how will that address the issue? Ultimately, those laws, or the new layer of law, will still need to be implemented where people do not hold to that new law that is being created. And so for this reason, we are concerned that the CRL's recommendations, even though well-intended, are not actually workable, will not actually make a difference in solving these issues, the issues that the current laws that are enough need to be applied. And an important question which is not addressed by the CRL report, and which this committee, I would respectfully submit, has to seriously consider before adopting the CRL's recommendations, relates to the costs involved in setting up, running, and monitoring these regulatory structures. Now, given that there may be over 500,000 religious practitioners who would need to be licensed in South Africa if the CRL's recommendations are to be adopted, it is evident that we're talking here about a fairly large, a massive bureaucracy that is likely to cost millions of rands per annum to run. Now, is this a responsible cost to add to the state fiscus? And if it is to be paid for by religious practitioners themselves or institutions, is this an appropriate cost for them to bear? Is it even legal to require them to pay in order to practice their faith and their occupation? So, Chair, then, in conclusion, if we are saying that the CRLs, we agree with the CRL that there are problems, we do not, however, agree with the solutions which they are proposing and which would require an amendment quite potentially of the Constitution and indeed of their own Act, what then are the viable alternative solutions? And we would propose that there are five solutions which we believe will bring greater levels of accountability to the religious community without the need for the state to intervene to actually amend the Constitution or the CRL's own Act. And it will also help to identify where there are potential problem areas so that the existing laws can be enforced. And these alternative solutions are set out from pages 12 onwards.
Yeah.
Indeed, Chair. Thank you so much. I'm just going to read the headlines. I'm not going to deal with the detail. You can go through that at your own time.
It was on the member's time. I thought you were going to conclude. But I should think, like you are saying, the headings are there. Support for the establishment of the ministers network and fraternals on a voluntary basis. They will go through them. It assists us because I wanted us to wrap up, they must have the night and go to the plenary. They are going to knock off at 20 hours tonight.
Chair, with your indulgence, there's perhaps just one slide which requires a little bit of explanation.
Sure.
So we're proposing these five solutions.
Which one?
The particular one that I just want to point to is alternative solution 5. Support the implementation of the CRL's power to register religious practitioners.
Slide 39, colleagues. Mm-hmm. 13,
Now, this one is a very important one to understand.
Mm.
The CRL Act already gives the CRL the power to keep a database of religious organizations.
Mm.
And what we are saying is that is a great idea. The CRL can already do that, because there is a massive difference between registration and regulation.
Okay.
When I go to the cell phone shop to get a cell phone, they ask me all kinds of details. What is your name? What is your address? I have no problem giving those details to them in order to get a cell phone. That's registration. However, when Vodacom is going to start asking me, what are you going to do with a cell phone? What's the nature of the messages that you're going to be sending? What's the content? Then I'm going to say to them, keep your cell phone. That's regulation. So we're staying very similar with the CRL. No problem asking basic details in terms of the name of the organization, where are you based, how many congregations, who's your financial officer for the foreign pastors, give us a copy of your visa, all those kind of things, because that will already kick up some of where the potential problems are. No problem. However, when we start looking at doctrine and practice in order to decide, is this person, are we okay with this person, are we not okay with that person, now we're getting into regulation, and that is where the problem lies. So registration, no problem. Regulation is where the problem lies. Chief, those are our submissions.
We know this report was presented to Parliament on the 14th of February 2018, the report that you're talking about. And I'm mindful of the fact that you made the submission to the CRL on May 17, 2017, wherein you were raising all those issues. And then also, this is what the committee noted, that the CRL did not do sufficient consultation, remember the school. And then also, the committee noted that there's been disagreement, like what you're doing now, over the constitutionality of the recommendation. Also, the emphasis that the committee then did was that the religion should not be commissioned. We know what we're talking about. And then also the committee observed that the denomination has been self-regulated and this has been looking like. That was the observation of the committee. And the other one to note that is to commercialize religion is an infringement of the personal rights. And also then that the CRL should not be the body that should be regulating the media sector. That was the observation of the committee then. Then they made recommendations. I think the recommendation to say there must be a national consultative conference that includes the linguistic and cultural committees. It should be convened. I think it's the REMA meeting that you are referring to in your document. And then arising from the NCC, this is what the committee recommended, that there has to be a charter for self-regulation. Secondly, there has to be a code of conduct for the sector to be recognized by legislation. So it means then, based on the implication of that recommendation, at the end it will be recognized by the legislation. For now, the legislation that says the constitution including the CRL Act itself, that deals with that. And then the other recommendation was just that we need to strengthen the mandate of ICASA and other related bodies to penalize misleading media claims and reporting, including advertising. Because you see this in TVs, how the churches are doing the things that the water will heal you, you won't take your ARVs, drinking, touching the holy water, then you are fine. That's the point, that was the rationale. The other one was that to say we need to strengthen the NPO and the income sector to ensure that those who are found wanting, then the law. We must appreciate that you have taken us through this so that you, and the proposal and what the law says, which were very much appreciative of that fact. Because now where we are seated, we are accused of not implementing the CRL recommendation, though report is approved by Parliament. And you all bear with us that it only came in late 2019. It's part of the legacy report, hence you remember, like you have correctly reported it. In December, we asked them to come and brief us on their report. We didn't say we were going to read the report as a committee and go ahead. We wanted to understand what were their reasons and everything. And the emphasis that I've always said is that there is no regulation that's going to take place for churches. But then like any other profession, you'll agree with me, even yourself, advocate, you belong to a bar or whatever, the law society, you know what I mean. That doesn't infringe your constitutional rights. But it's then, for your ethics, then we know who disciplines you in case you are found wanting. You see, that's the issue, eh? The ethics, code of ethics. So you are correct that, and it's voluntary, remember? You are not forced. You can practice on your own without belonging to any bar. You can still do that. You choose the choice. But for her as an attorney, she knows she must pay subscription fees, eh? Am I wrong? There is a profession that if you are found embezzling the client's money, you must have a trust account, or you know what I mean. So you belong to a structure. It's what they, it's called what the LPC now, Legal Practice Act. And it's an act that is governed. I'm giving classical examples based on your profession. So, fine, with self-regulation it's okay. Let's self-regulate. But when you are found wanting my case, who should discipline you? That's the point. You are found wanting. And then you are bringing the name of the religion into disrepute. We understand the criminal remedies opening a criminal charge. But then, under those circumstances, because this is the discussion that we are still going to engage with the law enforcement agencies. You have put the prescriptions, the law, failure to report, and all those things. Because we cannot run away from reality on what is happening on the ground. We have seen it. People who have been doomed. The success of those prosecutions and everything. But this is a matter that we are still going to engage in terms of, and we appreciate really meeting with you has helped us a lot and open our eyes. We want to appreciate us. And then also to give us the prescripts that govern this and all those things. We want to be appreciative of that. And it will be an ongoing engagement. Like, if we have just adopted our program in earlier before you came in, we have to hold a colloquium that deals with this matter on the 17th and 20th, the 18th of March. In an essence, in the spirit to deal with that report. Because then the report, as it is, you know, Parliament then approves part of the legacy report. And it will be a futile exercise for us to say, commission a go and do another research, you know, the course and everything. We've got so much things to do. Out of that, just the working documents and what. So at least now we need to just monitor the nature of our national consultative conferences, because that they are also required to host in terms of the law. Like you are putting it clearly here, what is within their mandate. What they need to do, what they need to do, but I didn't think that also because the resolution of Parliament was that it has been working well. If then we want to do other things, remember there must be regulatory impact assessment that must be done first. It's not just that you wake up today and say we want to regulate. You remember it's a tedious process that has to be taken. And then we cannot resolve one misconduct of one pastor by regulating. Let's deal with the culprit and make sure that the culprit is taken to book. Then we cannot just make the law to suit you, Daniela, because you are behaving in a proper way, then we must make a law to deal with you, Daniela. We can't do that. That's not how laws read. You know, that's the issue that you are raising. But remember, I'm trying to propose a way forward. We are still going to deliberate. We must appreciate all of you for taking time to take us through this. We sincerely appreciate it so that also we look at that prospect. But don't quote me out of context when I'm saying self-regulation is good, though there's got pros and cons. So the issue of the charter, because when I'm seated here, I don't get the sense that something on the slide that says in May, the Evangelical Association of South Africa, slide 40. So you're running the parallel program against the CRN. What made you not to talk to the CRN? What were the areas of differences? Because in the other meeting I attended in Japan, I could feel people are thinking there's going to be regulation of religion. And I went back again, read that report overnight. I don't see it in that report. We see you are going to regulate. It's a proposal, but then the detail about it, what was my worry factor when I came back was to go and check what did Parliament resolve on this matter so that I can be sure to say, well, this is a resolution of Parliament, what is this? Then when I come back, when I look at the resolution, I said, okay, the beauty about it is that the National Consultative for Conference that they are supposed to invite, as members of this portfolio committee, we're going to attend there so that we're not going to disclose what happened there. And we'll make sure that it's constituted in terms of what the law says. That's number one. And then the agenda, we'll look at that, what the law says about that, so that then we're able to deal with the issue. But as we are saying, well, even calling, we were having also a meeting with all the pastors before the ask to discuss these issues to say then what went wrong. You will all agree with me when we grow up. Miracles, the other colleagues were talking about miracles as we were discussing the conference earlier. But we must all agree what's happening in society is wrong. Ne? And then at times, you are a lawyer, you must assist us. You are not telling me about the vacuums that are there in the criminal law system, because certain charges as what the pastor has done here, there are other things that are done. And how do you deal with somebody who's brainwashed? How do you deal with somebody who's brainwashed to say, what crime? Did I give an example? There is this old lady that I always meet in the corner when I visited my mother. She stays in the village next to where my mother is. Every Sunday, because I've made it a norm before I come, decide I must go and see my mother, I'll find her at the corner of it. It's still far away. I think her home's a feather, 10K. She's coming from it. She attends a church 10 kilometers away from her home. That's the point that I'm trying to say. And then I know, because I know I'll pick her up, she will be smelly to show that she can't even afford a roll on sweat. Ne? And then also she doesn't even have money to take a taxi to go home. That's why she's hitchhiking. And she's an old woman. You can imagine the risk that she's going through. But every month she's paying tithes to the pastor. The pastor doesn't even care that, and she's using her social grant. She's a pensioner. That's the point. Ne? But she believes what she's doing in paying tithes is the right thing to do. But you can see this poor old lady can't even buy herself roll on in the truck price. She can't even have money to go, and then she has to hide, which also now given the society, the moral, she can even be raped. Some gangsters can even give her a hit one day and rape her coming from a church. How do you deal with that, a colleague? Isn't that we must discuss these issues freshly and openly? So thoroughly so. That's the point that we're trying to raise here with you. Just that is not like zero time, and we are saying, we have aside, I think it's 4 days, the other ones with the pastors themselves, the other one they have to focus on you. So then we start to engage on this matter. Seriously so, because even when we're here saying, yes, there's no regulation, we agree. But then don't call the corners, because the other issue, you have these special changes that are structured. Because that's the point that I want to give to you, to say they've got the branches like, I'll say, Pentecostal church, it's got branches nationally, ne? Then it will be easier to have an ethical code of conduct. But myself, I'm saying to Mutami, I decided to open a branch alone there, because that's what is happening of late. And then I'm the chairperson, I'm heading there, baby. Yeah, next, yeah, then there's a church there. Then when I misbehave, who regulates me under the second? Whom do I account, because I'm the sole practitioner here in this? You see? So I'm trying to just, I don't want you to respond now, but these are the issues that we need to ponder further and consider them, so that we start to, we are glad that you are having you, we appreciate you are a critical stakeholder and we are going to work with you, but you must assist us also to navigate from this. Because the people that are actually doing this, these people, it's a brand himself. And then he starts to doom. That chairperson who doomed people in Limpopo for it doesn't belong to any other group. It doesn't have branches. There's no church board there. It's a church board, it's the treasurer, it's everything. It's the secretary. It's the secretary, it's the treasurer. He accounts himself. The prophet is everything. I'm trying to raise this issue so that we're able to look at that. Let's not, I know you might be representing this structure and stages, we are fine. But the reality is that you've got this other one. And then how do you strike the balance? You see, we'll engage better, we've got emails. That's the point that I'm saying. We realize this is very useful. And then it's a pity, I don't know the processes, because whoever came before us, if they were concerned before we adopt the report, we could have listened. We don't know what were the processes towards the end of the report, because you had time also to also write to Parliament. I don't see anywhere in the letter where you wrote to Parliament having shown your discontent like you've done it to the Commission itself, because I think now as lawyers, you knew that the report was going to go to Parliament, and the parliamentary programs are public programs, eh? Like yours that we adopted it earlier. People were going to say that we were going to meet with you today, just that we're meeting with you when you're adopting the program. So then when you see this matter that we are going to deal with here, that's in my program that I said, we're going to have the India with the South African Religious Forum. I'm trying to say that, eh? You know we are going to discuss religious matters. You are free to write to me to say, even come to a meeting, make some meeting prior to that day to us as a committee for us to consider to say, but you are going to hold this in there. These are the issues that we feel, because our matters of mutual interest, matters that concern us as well. We feel this. And I mean, we are here, we are public representatives. There's no way that we are going to ignore that, because you are still going to give me the submission that people made to the committee then. The beauty about it, you still have the same committee secretary, same researcher here beside. The other people might have gone, but this one, I still need to look to say, when this matter was being processed by Parliament, post the CRL report, how many submissions were made to Parliament? Because you understand how Parliament works. People are free to submit. That's why I couldn't even refuse to meet you, because everybody is free to write to me. And I think that so far, colleagues, we have managed to listen to everybody. We even attend the petition, sit here the whole day, so that we listen to complaints of people, even call municipalities. Even when we know that certain thing is an overreach, you call it there. This should be dealt with at the local level. We've managed, because the complaint, no matter how small it is, it's a genuine complaint, and we've got responsibilities. We are public representatives to make sure that we address issues as concerned as a raised by people. So that's the matter that we don't need to sensationalize it. It's before us. Let's look at both sides of the coin, so that at the end of the day, our country is free from these other things that you see. Like, I mean, listen, Mishra, I was raised in the Lutheran community. There are certain things when, even when I go to church, or somebody starts to do it in my church, and in Lutheran, I say, this is not part of our religion. I feel offended. You know, I'll leave, because this is not the Lutheran church a religion. You see, tradition. So those are the things that we need to deal with, because whether we like it or we hate it, the reality is that there are pastors that have come into this country. They've tried to commissionize the religion. Even our own pastors at home here, they are emulating them. In fact, religion now is seen as a money-making scheme. We know people who have left their jobs, good paying jobs, to go to churches, because then what's wrong with the income tax? That's why I'm saying there's nothing wrong. And then it's just that is the system maybe that is failing to say somebody has to pay tax, somebody, but if I opt not to pay my taxes and then I'm not caught, it's only when I'm caught that I will comply. But there are those who have run away with me that were out. You know, that's what I'm trying to say. So basically, and then churches also, the registration and the database, we agree with you on that. But let's engage colleagues. I'm going to tell the landlord, say something quickly to the colleagues before I...
No, thank you, Chair. I was listening attentively to you, and then you represented us very well on this issue. Correct, so to say that the report has been adopted, but we have an open door policy as a committee, as the Chair was alluding to that fact. But I just want to say, just to emphasize on what the Chairperson was saying, we can't rush to solution to this problem that we are faced with. This needs all of us, whether you represent your structured churches or us as this portfolio committee representing the public. But the fact of the matter is that, as the chair was saying, we are dealing with a society. One, there's an economy that is playing itself in these things. A poor person who's not even educated, others are educated, but they are looking for miracles to get jobs. So it needs all stakeholders to have one common objective on how to solve this problem. We can't be saying this is wrong. The CRL also come with some of the solutions. They can't be right. They can't get it right from the beginning because it's not the problem that affects them only. Okay, they are expected from this point at this level to come with solutions because they deal with that aspect as CRL. But the fact of the matter, us as community, we are the ones who have supposed to come with solutions because we understand very well what you come from in society. If I may ask you, is what do you call yourself, South Africa for all? For us, yes, religion. If I can ask you, do you have a branch or do you work with someone in Soweto? Do you work with someone in Limpopo? Do you work with someone in Limpopo? What I'm trying to say to you, we can't have a fixed solution to this problem. So we must play our role as government as well. We must say to the economic development, okay, we know what is happening. This pastor is not because he wants to preach, he wants to practice religion. He wants money. Also, the church member is not going there to receive blessing, but she also wants to get some opportunities. She believes or he believes that if I have used that oil from that pastor, I'll be able to apply for the job. The fact of the matter is that there is an underlying factor of economy, unemployment, poverty. So if you are going to rush to say this solution that is proposed by CRL is wrong, and you are going to say to you, you are wrong, we are not going to get it right. So that's why the chairperson is saying, let us try to find time and engage all of us to have this problem solved. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick remark from my side. I'm glad that you say we're going to engage further on this report as well and with 4SA, although the report has already been adopted. And let's keep it that way so we can see if we can find a middle way between the committee's view and that of 4SA. And I will work to see that we can find a solution between what currently is in law, because I agree with your report, what's currently in law and what is actually happening practically, to see if there's a way between the two where we can actually settle. So that's from my side.
I can see that here they're writing all the pastors that they were doing concrete. But they proposed construction. And the one pastor who came with wheelchair, who came with wheelchair to the people, they said they can
put it on the sister of the matter and hear you who work.
Okay. Pastor Chris, who came with people with the wheelchair and made that and said to the congregation, I can make this person to walk. Why did that person is walking? He's not a wheelchair. He came with him to the congregation. Okay, that, yes, you must write him here. Again, the one that he, the other pastor that he claimed to waking up a person from the coffin, can write, must, all of them, these sorting pastors, they must be on book. We must read with them all over where we go. Yes, because and otherwise, the one that you make people to, who make the building to fall on top of the people, while he was not inside the...
In Nigeria.
You see, South African, many South Africans were dying there. Joshua, Tibi Joshua. Yes, you must write every pastor that are doing wrong things to people so that they will be known. I can see some of them. But you also, Chairperson, I can say, I'm covered, but I can say thank you to the 29, to the 39 clause. I can see the clarification of, I love this one. Page 13 and 39 clause. I love that. And I support that 100%.
Chair,
okay, thank you, Chairperson. I think we welcome their presentation very well. And then even ourselves, we have responded to their, you know, presentation very well. We need not even also just to say this is what you are going to end. But what I can ask you to do, CRL, they are doing a good job for you to understand what is it that they are doing. You should also help them in that packaging of the churches that you are in, so that we are well advanced with the information of the good and the bad and the advantage that you are giving now. So now I thank you very much.
Sorry, before we. Do you know, are you familiar with Cowlitz? Yeah. Do you walk around, drive around the house often? Do you see many people under the tree? Group by group, those are churches. What are you saying?
No, it's not a church. Church is a real church. It's not a thing, Zion.
I don't know. There are just churches under the bridge. Many groups are churches. What are
those dangerous places.
What are you saying? Please look at before you come to us. Tell us which danger did you see is caused by pastors who open churches each and everywhere, as our chaplain was saying. In Ivory Park, Midrand, I can see. Thank you.
You know, people, what he's saying, Chairperson, what he's saying, I support her 100%. You know, in Pretoria, I'm from Pretoria, these people, they are wearing white clothes. They are having churches beside the road, on top of the mountain, near the river, and then under the bridge. Go and conduct a thorough research. Next time when you come, you give our chaplain the report. What is it? Yes.
Thank you. I was the executive director when he was opening up he opened with a disclaimer of doctrinal neutrality. And this is actually cultivated. This has actually cultivated some curiosity in me as to what is the clinical delineation between the behavior and the right. Because I understand that my right to individual freedom, my right to dignity and individual freedom is integral to the right of others. Now, the issue of the saving angels was just a tip of the iceberg. Because a number of phenomena, very strange, I don't want to say absurd or bizarre, phenomena, happening within communities, disguised as religion, where these are religious sects, cults. Now, to me, the chair has indicated that this committee is not for regulation. But how do you differentiate between an object in religion that you cannot regulate and a behavior, a conduct of an individual?
to deal with the conduct of the individual, other than the doctrine. You have to regulate that behavior. As a preventative measure, because that law she's coming with is after the effect, when a crime has been committed. So you require a measure that is a deterrent to crime. That is the behavior of the individual. So it's not saying that the state will ever regulate a doctrine or a regime, but the state must make sure that there is a measure, not to control, but as a deterrent to unbecoming behavior. So I don't think that the state will go, unless I have a different understanding. My understanding of the recommendation of the commission was not to regulate religion, but was to say, do yourself, to me, a peer review mechanism is a self-regulation by institutions and affairs, not to regulate as a state. That's my understanding. So I'm on a different page as to peer review mechanism, because this you do among yourselves, so that the code of conduct among yourselves about religion as a profession. Otherwise, if untrammeled, the rights are not licensed. So there is a general limitation to rights in terms of the general application of law. So there is no right that is open-ended, that I will do whatever I want while trembling on the rights of others. So this is the measure that we must establish, a critical balance on these matters. Tell Chef.
Then, colleagues,